This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frain is our technical director this afternoon. Let's get started in our interview portion of the program. And here's how we're going to do it. Our topic this afternoon is women in rock. Let's get started by hearing Big Mama Thornton, Hound Dog.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Mama Thornton, Hound Dog. Women in Rock is our topic this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest is journalist Jerry Hirschi, a contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine. She's also written about music and the arts for several other publications, including the Washington Post and the New York Times Magazine. She's also the author of two books on music. Nowhere to Run, The Story of Soul Music was her first book. Her new book is We Gotta Get Out of This Place, The True Tough Story of Women in Rock. Big Mama Thornton is one of the women Hirschi writes about in her new book. Thornton's Hound Dog made it to the top of the R&B charts in 1953. Thornton was paid for her recording in a lump sum, one check, $500. Hirschi's book is a history that begins with the pioneers of women in rock. They are included in a chapter titled Mothers of Invention. The book goes on to cover four decades of women in rock. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Jerry Hirschi. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. We Gotta Get Out of This Place is published by the Atlantic Monthly Press. Jerry, good afternoon. Welcome.
Afternoon. Thank you, Celeste.
Sure. What else would you like to tell us about Big Mama Thornton?
Well, now, I'd like you to take, well, you must know, but if your readers want to take a guess, or your listeners, she sold 2 million copies of that record in 1953, and that lump sum payment was $500. Mm-hmm. That's as good as it ever got for her.
Yeah, man, that is tough. You talked about her with bluesman B.B. King. What did he...
I did. Well, I was asking B.B., who at the time I was out on the road with him was celebrating his 50th year on the road, and I said, well, you know, what were your impressions of how tough it was for blues women? And he said, you can't imagine. He said it was bad for us, just in terms of the primitive conditions and whatnot. It was very rough for them, but the thing that women, particularly Big Mama, had to contend with was if promoters did not find them personally attractive, if they didn't want more from them than a few songs, they might not get booked. And that a woman like Big Mama, who was not the most conventionally handsome woman you've ever seen, had a particularly difficult time. You really had to, as he said, sing like crazy and have a huge hit record before some of these guys would even pay attention to you. And that's where it started, of course, was with the local club bookers.
Yeah. Now, that's not to say that women in music didn't have their indulgences.
Well, no. Most of the early blues women were, as I like to call it, women of appetites. And I do mean appetites that extended into every area you could imagine. I mean, Bessie Smith, for instance, liked to live very well and was well enough off, was successful enough to be able to do that, to avoid many of the difficulties of racism on the road by buying her own railroad car, having a perpetual champagne party on that car, which was big enough to accommodate her tent pole for her tent shows, and have sort of hot and cold running chorus kids, you know, when the appetite struck as well. So, you know, I think that these were and continue to be, if you look at rock and roll today and you kind of listen to the celebrity aspect of it, women who have a lively appetite for all aspects of pleasure in life.
In terms of what they're paid and how much say they have in how they're packaged and sold to the public today, how are women in the music business doing?
I think they're doing much, much better, and I think the main reason is that they're so much better educated. This does go for male artists as well, of course, but I am struck by the fact now that when I talk to, let's say, an 18 or 19-year-old rap singer, she knows all about her publishing rights. She knows what kind of endorsement she should expect. She knows how big a publicity staff she should have. There is a lot more machinery in place to help you make the right decisions, whereas someone like Big Mama, you know, someone comes along with a contract and offers you $50 and you sign away everything. So, in terms of education and whatnot, it's much, much better. I think the battles are still being fought in terms of image, you know, in terms of the particularly sexual image and what one might be pushed to do. I think that, Pat Benatar tells a story of, and that was quite a while ago, 15 years maybe, where suddenly a poster appeared of her and the record company had airbrushed half her shirt off without her permission. Mm. They shortly thereafter parted company. It might not be that extreme, but there still is a certain pressure, I think, felt to really put out in that way if one can be persuaded to do so. But I also have to point out that at the same time, there are many women who consider that, a personal expression of freedom and will, a la Mariah Carey, completely change their image and go farther than perhaps, you know, some male director of publicity would ever ask her to do. So, but at least at this point, it's their choice.
Right, right. You know? In the chapter on the 90s, you write about women who are angry and interested in getting angry, getting even, and having fun. And one of the ways that some of these women have done that has been to what you call Cuisinart their femininity.
Absolutely. I mean, if you take someone like Courtney Love, when she started out with Hole, what they would do would be wear sort of a grotesque caricature of all kinds of, you know, cultural female images. She'd wear baby doll clothes, smear lipstick across her face, and then dare you to call her a sexual toy. You know, I think that, Bikini Kill, you know, write the word slut across your chest as you're performing, or do it performing topless and dare see what the punk boys will do with you then. You know, it is drawing a certain line in the sand, and on some levels it's having fun with the whole notion of what is correct and what is not. Mm.
Let's go back to the birthing of rock and roll. The blues, as we mentioned, Big Mama Thornton was one of the genres of music that gave birth to rock. But as you point out, jazz, country, and gospel music are in rock's family tree as well.
Oh, absolutely. Gospel is total bedrock for, particularly for most of the singers who came to the fore in the 60s, the Motown singers and the Aretha Franklins of the world, all of these people, and even some of the rap musicians today were raised in church. And those rhythms and those phrasings are totally gospel and absolutely infuse the music. Country music, I don't think there is anyone from Bob Dylan, you know, on up through Steve Earle today who would discount for a second the influence of Mother Maybelle Carter,
mm-hmm.
And the Carter family on what is now more considered folk music, and then country music is absolute bedrock in terms of storytelling, melody, and Mother Maybelle's absolutely revolutionary form of guitar playing. So all of those streams came into rock and roll, and all of them had women working at the very center. They may not have been heard as well, or at the top of any business organizations and record companies, but they have always been there, as I like to say, and they have never been quiet.
Thinking of Mother Maybelle Carter, you write about her in the book, and you write about how you were blown away by seeing footage from television of the women of the Carter family, together with Johnny Cash, performing "Were You There When They Crucified My Lord?" And here we have country and gospel together. I'm wondering if it's possible for you to give our listeners some sense of that performance.
Well, it is. It's a stunning performance. The song, which one can still get on certain Johnny Cash compilations. A little background here is that Johnny Cash was soon to marry Maybelle's daughter, June Carter. And his attachment to the family went long before that. Mother Maybelle really was one of the people who reached out and saved his immortal soul when he was so deep into drugs and whatnot, would literally lock him into rooms. And Maybelle did that with more than one kind of lonesome cowboy singer, Hank Williams being another, Jimmy Rogers being another. And so there they are on this kind of hokey stage setting, as one has in those days, black and white, you know, kind of rifle hanging over a fake fireplace. But the song, it's a trade-off between Johnny, that low baritone, and the Carter sisters. And at that point, Anita, who is a daughter, takes a high answer to Johnny Cash apart. And it is, she had what Elvis called, and Johnny Cash still, the most stunning voice in country music, Anita Carter. Elvis was madly in love with her. It's hard to, you know, without playing, it's hard to describe. It's an absolutely bone-chilling moment where you cannot tell whether Anita has seen what's beyond the grave or seen the face of the Lord, but she's clearly someplace else. And it's one of those echoes in country music that has echoes of those preachers who came over on the Mayflower, the you know, fire and brimstone, God-fearing exiles. It's really just quite an astonishing moment, and these people did this regularly and had such a following, particularly when they got on border radio outside Mexico that could, that they like to say it hit Chicago from down in Texas.
It did.
Yeah. that it absolutely knocked people to their knees, you know, while at the same time being very down-home, very folksy. And the other thing about Maybelle and Sarah, the two sisters, was that besides being, you know, wonderful human beings, they had the most amazing light blue eyes that could just see right through you. I think it was Ernest Tubb used to like to say, "Mama just whips us with those eyes." Mm. They were women who just commanded, you know, a respect and an adoration that we perhaps, you know, can't understand now in these current times of celebrity, but was absolute.
You also write in that portion of the book about a group that I had never heard of before, the Clara Ward Singers. The first girl group, you said, that left you thunderstruck.
Well, I must confess to my you know, my ancient roots here, but there used to be, I guess it was in the 60s, a show called Hootenanny, which was a folk show. And one day came the Ward Sisters, and if you were a white girl raised in the suburbs, as I was, you would not have been in a church and regularly seen such amazing performances. But these were several large women with great theatrics. So they had these hairdos that went up about a foot and a half, each one of them. And despite their size, they would leap into the air with absolute ecstasy. I mean, it was clearly, you know, performance and faith-driven ecstasy. And I can only liken it to the first time I saw James Brown dance on the Ed Sullivan Show. You know, there was something otherworldly going on. But the Ward Singers, I come to find out later when I kind of got into this business and spent some time with Aretha Franklin, were Clara Ward was Aretha's mentor, who literally took care of her when she was a child. Aretha's mother had died early, and her dad was a minister, and Clara would sing in the church, the Ward sisters would. And she grew up, Aretha grew up, being essentially raised by Clara Ward, by Mahalia Jackson. I mean, it couldn't get much better than that.
Oh, really?
But, you know, I certainly did not know this at the time. I was just, as I was with that Carter performance, absolutely riveted by the, you know, just the clear stream of faith and ecstasy that goes through those moments. You know, it's unmistakable, and, you know, I don't think it would translate well to MTV, but through that grainy black and white, it came through.
Yeah. Are these performances preserved in a documentary anywhere?
Well, you know, here and there, there is footage of the Carters. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, Nashville kinds of stuff. And, in fact, I've seen a good deal of it. I've seen some of their home movies. But it's, by and large, you know, a lot of that is the fairly hokey, stilted, sort of hee-haw type format. The Ward singers, you can pretty much only find on, you know, if they've preserved these old kind of folky shows. There was a wonderful gospel documentary called Say Amen, Somebody, which dealt with some other people, Thomas Dorsey among them, which I would recommend to anyone. I believe that was a PBS documentary. It was fabulous. That really does convey to you the commitment and the ecstasy behind that kind of gospel art. And it's just so much fun to watch.
Jerry Hershey is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's a journalist. She's author of the book, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, The True Tough Story of Women in Rock. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222. 9455 800-222-WILL. When you were growing up, Jerry, were you enthusiastic about all kinds of music?
I was. I mean, I was, you know, pretty much a fan before I ever got into this business. I loved rock and roll. I didn't, as I was growing up, I didn't know much about gospel. You know, I listened to my dad's Tony Bennett records and all that kind of stuff. But it was in the 60s. I literally ran my first light when I first heard Aretha Franklin on the radio. Mm. She was singing I Never Loved a Man. And that, in fact, was one of my first interviews ever with Aretha. And pretty much changed my life in terms of saying, gee, you know, this is wonderful. This is somebody, people I'd like to spend more time with and learn more about. And, you know... How awfully nice to get paid for doing something like that. And I do, you know, you frequently have those moments where you're standing in the wings at some incredible show. You're traveling with B.B. King. I had the same feeling. My gosh, you know, somebody's paying me to do this. And it's great. And the conversations are wonderful because, particularly with a lot of the soul and Motown folks that I wrote about the first time around in my first book and also again in this book, when they were doing... their best in terms of selling records and all that sort of thing and being on Ed Sullivan, no one was talking to them. They were not doing interviews. You know? They would be on Johnny Carson, but he wouldn't invite them onto the couch. I mean, there was still a sort of subtle difference in how black performers were dealt with for the most part. And so when you finally do get to them, they were very happy to talk, you know, and amazing stories came out because besides the music itself, which is fascinating, and, you know, especially if you're a fan and you grew up with it, these are people who had to contend with a very difficult way of traveling and working in America because segregation was still a problem when they started, and still, you know, that means even now there are still some problems for some of these folks. So you got... some amazing personal histories that really resonate beyond a 45 record to what was going on in the country at the time. So it's very kind of rewarding to do the kind of thing to do, is go around and take these oral histories, you know, of people who really had great and sometimes difficult experiences out on the road, on the Motown bus.
Yeah. And today, it's so nice to hear these voices through your book, because we haven't heard these folks on the radio for a long time now. But they're still, many of them are still out performing.
Absolutely. I mean, I spent some time not long ago with Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and Mary, who I've known for years, said to me, "This is my life. I'm not, you know, I can't give it up." So she does a lot of oldie shows. She does a lot of corporate work. Many people do what they call corporate work now, which is quite lucrative and can be kind of fun. And Ronnie Spector of the Ronettes, who lives right near me up here, Ronnie has sort of found a whole different constituency. She's singing with punk girls now sometimes, and she's fabulous, and she's having a great time. And she said the same thing to me: "Look, I am rock and roll. You know, her hits were, might have been 1961, 62, but here I am, and her teenage sons are turning her on to, you know, whomever they might like. But, you know, as I say to you, you know, you're kind of stuck with this life. You can't tame it. You can't quit it. It is what you love, so you have to find a way to do it, even if you're not at the center of the charts right now." And so many of them have. And it's, you know, it's great. There's another woman in the book, Wanda Jackson, who most people have never heard of. Now, Wanda was a favorite of Elvis. And Wanda was such an amazing country singer that she could, you know, just blow the best country musicians off the stage. And Elvis said to her, because he was such a fan, "You know, you can do what I do. You should do what I do." And this was in the mid-50s, and she did. And if you listen to any of these records that she made, notably something called Let's Have a Party, you know, it's like nuclear fission in the control room of the record company. And Wanda had the misfortune to kind of rock too hard and rock too soon as a woman, you know. So what is Wanda doing now? She's a grandma. She's still rocking. She's still wearing the fringe and spaghetti straps when she wants. And she also sings gospel and sings in church, but she's still working and she's still having a great time.
Mm. Let's talk with a listener, someone who's waiting to talk with us in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi, can you guys hear me?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. I have a question not about artists, women in rock music, like the musicians. I have more of a question for the author about women in positions similar to hers as journalists, as DJs, as programmers at radio stations, as owners of labels or promoters for shows. And publicists, I've noticed in the last 10 years, and I've worked in the business, I don't work in it right now on a major level, but that there is a serious decrease in women, as there has been an upswing of female artists making records, and your Britney Spears and your Mandy Moores, and they seem to get younger and younger, but as I've grown older, I've noticed a lot of women not getting as involved in label activity or journalism, and I was wondering if you have any comment on why the climate seems to have changed. I mean, I just read Michael Azarath's book, Our Band Could Be Your Life, and even though so few of the artists were women, the whole indie ethos was basically about, you know, it was anti-sexist, or a lot of it was, and there were a lot more women, because that's kind of when I was coming up through the scene. There were a lot more women doing fanzines, starting labels, doing promotions and publicity. They were doing it all on their terms, and they were choosing who they worked with. And I'm wondering if you have any idea why that seems to be kind of on the wane right now.
Well, I can only make a guess at it and tell you what I've seen. I you know, there is no objective study on this. I think you saw certainly more women, particularly in that early indie scene and early rap scene. It was very interesting that when rap was first getting a toehold in Manhattan and in those record areas, you'd find all of these kind of tough young women as either record company heads, publicists, or whatever. Monica Lynch is one person I think of,
right,
at Tommy Boy, who was, you know, I would meet her running around with James Brown and Afrika Bambaataa. I do think that as things have become more relentlessly corporate, you run into the same kind of glass ceiling that you run into in any other, you know, widget-making company.
Well, and I even noticed that here, we're in a university town, and there are very few, at least at the college level. I'm talking about younger women. I'm in my early 30s. I'm not talking necessarily about women my age. I'm talking about younger college women don't seem interested at all.
I think they know it's not the prettiest game in town. I think, you know, I think women are pretty smart.
Sure.
And, I mean,
so
I
much
see
fun
now.
Back then, you know, I mean, I feel sad that there's a whole generation of women who are really missing out on the whole DIY thing and, like, really taking charge and saying, you know, we don't like this music. We don't like this music that we're being fed. We don't like the way women are being portrayed in rock music. You know, even somebody like Courtney Love, who really started off making all these incredible statements about being a woman in the rock scene, she's totally sold out. I mean, all her litigation aside, you know, that's really cool and awesome, but, you know, you look at her and it's really hard to take her seriously anymore.
It is. I mean, people get... I had a similar kind of difficult discussion with Mariah Carey where I sort of touched on this before. She was explaining to me how wonderful it was to get out from under her ex-husband, Tommy Mottola, at the record company and out of the marriage, and she was sick of the little girl image that they had imposed on her. And then I look at the remix video that's been sent to me, and there she is wearing virtually nothing, splayed across the hood of Snoop Dogg's Cadillac or Chevy Impala, having water thrown all over her.
Right, kind of makes you wonder.
I mean, so this is, you know, this is her choice, and I respect that,
sure.
Her ability to make that. But is this progress? You know, who's to say? But I, you know, it does seem to be that we're kind of backwashing with this. I also, you know, I look at the sly and canny striptease that Britney Spears has been doing, every video, you know, more salacious than the next. This was predictable from the jump. And I think, I mean, the only interesting thing here is that I think she's as much the architect as any record company guy. You know, call me cynical, but I do think she probably is on board with this totally. It's not, you know, it's not terribly encouraging. I can go, I remember not long ago, maybe a year ago, going to an editorial meeting at Rolling Stone where I have worked for many years, and there were maybe 25 people around the table, and I was the only girl.
I know how you felt.
What's happened here?
I know how you felt.
You know, I don't get it.
I was the only, I was one of two women at a really small record label, where it was really hard, I think, at times to sort of get involved in the sort of male mentality that was there. Even though these were totally cool guys, it was like, you know, the women were completely at the outside of it. You know?
It's a boys' club still, you know, by and large. This is not to say, you know, that tremendous advances have not been made.
No, I agree with that.
You know, the days of Big Mama Thornton, but it is very much so. And I think, you know, you run into people like Sylvia Rhone at Elektra, who is this amazing, dynamic, take-no-prisoners kind of a leader. But by and large, they're fairly rare. I think that in the corporate arena, the women who have the highest profile still, and they did 20 years ago, are the publicists. And for better or for worse. And many of them are not exactly policymakers. Sometimes it's just that awful hard job of running around with an 18-year-old rapper,
right,
and making sure he's got
babysitting.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I guess I feel like I'm even seeing fewer women doing that. It seems like they're kind of just dropping out altogether. I don't know.
I find the industry itself extremely frustrating at this point because, as I say, it is so corporate. I think perhaps I may be reading things into it, but I think that women have a lower tolerance for nonsense. You know, I think they can see the writing on the wall and say, you know, I don't need this because it's not any artist. I mean, I not long ago listened to Sting do a 45-minute diatribe on what's happened with the industry and the difficulties of, you know, anything interesting getting airplay. It's a pretty widespread feeling, but it's a very difficult one to challenge and rather daunting to do it alone, to say, I'm going to go in there and fix this, you know, or I'm going to make a difference. I think that that probably seems quixotic to the intelligent woman, you know.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What kind of impact do you think MTV has had on women in rock?
Oh, huge,
yeah.
Huge. I think that it's so much easier now, you know, for any kind of artist, but more so for women to break in and make a difference. And, of course, the example one has to give here is Madonna. If you look at the two supernovas that came right after the dawn of MTV, which I believe was 1980, it started in August of 1980, Michael Jackson and Madonna, both of them were, you know, absolutely suited to this kind of protean, change your image tomorrow, new medium. And I think that women have been particularly good at it because image and appearance has always had been emphasized more with women, you know, for better or for worse. But given the opportunity to make it work for you, a la Madonna, you know, totally change yourself with each video, you couldn't ask for better. And I think that it was a way, particularly if you're not that strong a vocalist as Madonna is, or a killer stage performer, it was another way to make an impact. You know, it's sort of a whole different area of talent that had not been, or dress up, if you want to call it that, that had not been exploited before. And I think that some people were very canny and interesting, like Annie Lennox of Eurythmics with that. I think Tina Turner was very smart with the way she did things. Cyndi Lauper certainly was just this wonderful cartoon that burst into our lives. That, it was a great thing. It was, you know, I think that a lot of the women showed, particular talent for that. And certainly, I have seen, because I've also covered the fashion industry a bit, the fashion industry jumped right in with them. And, you know, everybody would be dying to do your tour, and every designer now wants Mary J. Blige at their shows in Milan. You know, it's a certain kind of cross-pollination that works very well.
Yeah. And fashion has been really important for years and years, decades.
It is. I mean, let's just look at rock and roll in general. I mean, where would Elvis be without that gold lamé suit, you know, and his flashy clothes? It has always been paramount. It's always the, you know, the more outrageous look, the better. And it's fun and it's wonderful if it's, you know, it's kept in a certain perspective. So it's always been right there in the middle. I mean, Mick Jagger will tell you, you know, that he knew early on to make friends with Cecil Beaton, the photographer who would get him into Vogue, because it was another, you know, was another inroad. To make friends with Diana Vreeland, the editor of Vogue, and, you know, get seen by the right people. David Bowie, you know, the best mannequin in the world. Armani, all these people would be dying to dress you. And so it's worked, and it's worked from the beginning. I mean, those nudie suits that Elvis wore and James Brown wore, by the fashion, I hesitate to call him a designer, nudie. He punched a lot of rhinestones. But, you know, they're tremendous collectibles today. They're really, you know, American classics. So, I've always felt that you can't really cover rock and roll, especially rock and roll as we know it today, MTV eyes, without understanding its relationship to the fashion industry.
Yeah, there's a really nice little anecdote that you tell in the book about a couple of young women who are working at an Old Navy store. I believe they're working at the store, and what they look like, they're young women, and they're totally in tune.
Oh, they were. Well, one of them, I was asking her about something on the rack, but then I looked at her nail polish and I looked at her hair and I said, oh, Mary J. Blige, whatever album, and she said, oh, yes, you know. I mean, we started to laugh, but, you know, girls have been doing that forever. I mean, you know, we did that. People did that with the Ronettes. I just went to a luncheon honoring Ronnie Spector, the Ronettes, and was sitting with Patti Smith, who was giving her an award that day. And Patti said, you know, I wanted to be Ronnie Spector. I teased my hair like that. I put on that eyeliner, you know, and it's really still the same thing. You know, teenage girls are teenage girls. And, you know, I'm not sure what I'd do if my 9-year-old tried to get herself up as Christina Aguilera, but you know, it is a very time-honored phenomenon.
We've got to wrap it up here pretty quickly, but before we go, I want to. Well, you didn't mention the women of the '70s, and there are some great women rockers in the '70s: Joni Mitchell, Patti LaBelle, Carly Simon, Gladys Knight, Chaka Khan, Patti Smith, Emmylou Harris, and so on. So to wrap up here, my question on the '70s, we'll just push it all together, ball it all up. If you were to write a biography of one of the women from the '70s, who would you choose as your subject and why?
Boy, that's a hard one. You know, I think that probably it would be the hardest job in the world. But I think I would probably choose Joni Mitchell because I think she was so much the fountainhead of all of this singer-songwriter stuff that has been so popular in recent years, from, you know, Alanis Morissette to Tori Amos to anyone you could name, Ani DiFranco. But I also felt at the time, being just kind of college student at the time, that this was a person who really caught the times as a songwriter very well, too, and also really understood women. Now, you know, oddly enough, she would get very angry and snarl at you if you suggested that she was, you know, a good women songwriter. But she...
Rightfully so.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. She is a good songwriter, but I think that... let me put it this way. At the time, she lived the kind of life that most intelligent young women aspired to. You know, it was arty, it was intelligent, it was brave, it was different. I would like to trace the arc of that life, I think I would, but I think, again, knowing what I do of her and her, shall we say, rather irascible nature, I think it'd be a very hard job. But, of course, those are always the ones worth doing.
Mm. Yeah. We've got to leave it at that, Jerry. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Jerry Hirshey has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of 2 books on music. Nowhere to Run, The Story of Soul Music was her first book. Her new book is We Gotta Get Out of This Place, The True Tough Story of Women in Rock. We Gotta Get Out of This Place is published by the Atlantic Monthly Press.